candy?
Ah!
It's gluten one day, then trans fatty acids the next. Then it's salt you've got to watch out for. Or wait, is salt good for you now? There's always a villainous ingredient sending us to the fridge for a purge. Just like our friends on South Park.
Wait, I like those.
Chicken nuggets, breaded, frozen burritos, flour, ice cream. What about ice cream?
I don't know. Look at the ingredients.
Heavy cream, sugar, chocolate syrup. No, ice cream's good for you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll look a little more closely at one of those ingredients. I'm talking about sugar. And we'll investigate exactly what we mean when we say a food is good or bad for you. Later in the show, we're talking about beer, because clearly that is good for you. I'd like to welcome James DeNicolantonio to Central Standard. He's a research specialist for St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute. Hi, James.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times all about the health risks associated with sugar. In the article, you describe a study your team has conducted showing that sugar, more than salt, contributes to cardiovascular problems. Tell us about that study.
Sure. So when we're talking about sugars, we're talking about added sugars. And those two added sugars in particular are added sugars that contain fructose. So that would be sucrose, also known as table sugar, or high fructose corn syrup. And these two types of added sugars seem to specifically spike blood pressure right after you consume it. So you can get a spike up to about 15 on the top number and about 10 on the bottom number. And these type of elevations can last up to 2 hours. And when you continuously consume it, what ends up happening is you get insulin resistance and a higher insulin level, which activates the sympathetic nervous system. So now you have a higher heart rate as well as a higher blood pressure chronically going forward.
Yikes. That doesn't sound good. You talk about fructose in particular. Are there other kinds of sugar that have these same consequences, or are we talking specifically about that table sugar, the white crystally stuff?
Well, yeah, the message isn't that we want to switch from these added sugars that contain fructose to artificial sweeteners, because actually some artificial sweeteners have been shown to also induce insulin resistance. So we're talking about switching from processed foods high in these added sugars towards whole foods that contain natural sugars. And the whole foods, those sugars are going to be buffered by fiber and phytonutrients. So that isn't an issue. It's the refined sugars that's the problem.
So you also cite mounting evidence that sugar has other health risks besides the cardiovascular implications you've laid out for us. What are some of the other health risks related to sugar?
So the added sugars that contain fructose are metabolized differently than glucose. So fructose gets hit by the liver. About 80% of it gets hit by the liver right away, and the liver only has a certain capacity to metabolize fructose. So what ends up happening is you get oxidative stress and inflammation when you consume too much, and you get a fatty liver. And that leads to the pancreas having to produce more insulin because the liver is now insulin resistant.
And fatty liver,
that's
an actual diagnosis, right? Not just a description.
Correct. That's an actual diagnosis.
With serious implications?
Well, yes. Fatty liver leads to insulin resistance of the liver, which leads to overall body insulin resistance. So your pancreas has to produce more insulin, and now you start storing more fat throughout the entire body. So that leads to obesity, and then it leads to type 2 diabetes, also high blood pressure. So really all the chronic diseases that we're facing today, it can be traced back to the overconsumption of these added sugars.
So at the heart of this, though, these are serious complications, really bad stuff that can happen from too much sugar. But the heart of your argument in this article is that you're saying what people who can't keep their hands out of candy bowls have been saying for a long time. Sugar is also addictive.
That's absolutely correct. So when we consume sugar, what happens is we get an intense release of dopamine and opioids. And it's a supraphysiologic release, meaning that we've never actually had this type of intense release of opioids and dopamine. We don't get that when we consume fruit. And so we get it basically overrides our self-control mechanisms. And the fructose part actually doesn't provide satiety. It actually drives hunger. So you get cravings, you're more hungry, you overconsume. And after a while, the brain actually gets depleted of opioids and dopamine. So once you're depleted, you're always in this withdrawal state. So you always need to get that dopamine and opioid release again. So it's a vicious cycle of intense release of opioids and dopamine. You eventually get a depletion of that in the brain, and you have to continually consume added sugars to get that high.
I feel a little like we're having that conversation of like, what? There's something in your kitchen right now that's going to kill you. I mean, how do you reconcile the really severe consequences we're talking about and the level of fear people are likely to attach to this really common substance as a result?
So you have to fix the biochemistry first in order to fix sugar addiction. So the best way to do that is obviously to reduce your consumption. And most people don't even understand that they're consuming it because it's hidden in 75% of all packaged foods in the United States. So when they can start looking at the nutrition label and they can start trying to understand if it's added sugar in the product or not, which is kind of hard to do until the FDA actually mandates added sugars to be placed on the label. But really the message is switching from processed foods to whole foods, because whole foods aren't going to have these added sugars.
Well, let's get back to this issue of addiction for just a second, because some of the hallmarks of addiction are things like cravings, tolerance, and withdrawal. And I think we all know how sugar cravings play out, and you've described somewhat what happens with the withdrawal. But what about sugar tolerance? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So there's actually a decrease in acetylcholine when you ingest sugar, and that's the tolerance part. So that there's no satiety, and that leads you to escalate your intake. And also, when you get the deficiency in opioids and dopamine, you have to continually increase your intake to get the same high. So that leads to the escalation in intake and the binging, and then you get the withdrawals from being in a low opioid dopamine deficient state in the brain.
So a low opioid
can also lead to ADHD.
The low opioid deficient state, can you describe that in lay people's terms? Like, what am I experiencing when I'm in that state?
So most people understand endogenous opioids as endorphins or enkephalins. And so there's a reduction in enkephalins, which is your basic natural opioids. And so what happens is now you don't have the normal opioids in your brain that you used to. You have a deficiency. And so you constantly need to be ingesting sugar to get the opioid level back to where it was.
What does an opioid level that is normal feel like to what does it feel like to a person? And what does an opioid level that is depleted feel like?
So depleted, you're going to always feel in a sense of urgency, a sense of importance to obtain a substance that's rewarding. Whereas when you have a natural and you're in a physiologic state of, let's say, natural opioids and dopamine in the brain, you don't have this urge, this craving to ingest a food to get a high.
Okay. Well, so am I tired? Am I energetic and like amped up?
So actually, it can be both. So if you already have insulin resistance, and what happens a lot of times is when you ingest the sugar, your blood sugar levels drop really quickly. And so you get nervous, shaky, sweaty, and you get very anxious. So until you have another sugar consumption, you know, until you consume another soft drink, your blood sugars are going to be low. So you're in that state of feeling shaky, jittery, sweaty until you get that rise in sugar. But the problem is you crash again. So you're in this constant cycle of low blood sugar, high blood sugar, and you can't get out of it.
With artificial sweeteners, does the same thing happen? I mean, are we just failing to address the craving when we substitute those things, or can they be a gateway out of the cycle?
So it depends. Certain people can tolerate the artificial sweeteners a little bit better than sugar, but some can't. And so artificial sweeteners induce insulin resistance by altering your gut microbiota, but they have the same type of stimulation from the taste receptors to the brain causing addiction. So it's that sweet taste that hits your brain because your brain connects with your palate via nerves. And so it's that same reward and you're getting the same release. But the problem is you don't get the sugar on board. So your body freaks out and it says, wait a second, I just had a sweet taste. Where's the sugar? So then you go out and seek the sugar anyway. So really artificial sweeteners aren't the substitute for this problem.
So our craving for sweet things is actually a survival instinct. Is that right?
Yes, because when we would consume fruits before winter, so the fruits would be available in the summer when we were in the Paleolithic times, it would allow us to store more fat and it would help us get us through those times of food scarcity. So the more rewarding it was, the more someone was likely to seek it out, eat it, store more fat, and survive for the next year. So it's an innate reward that we have. And the problem is, though, is that these sugars have been refined to white powder. So They've been refined to the point, just like cocaine and heroin or other white crystals. So they're causing, basically, they're hijacking our brain chemistry, which doesn't happen when you eat a piece of fruit.
The comparison to cocaine, for example, is a shocking one. But in your article, you do write about studies where lab animals have a surprising response by comparison to cocaine. Can you talk about that?
Sugar is much more rewarding in rats than cocaine is. So, in fact, even if you hook the rats on IV cocaine, almost all of them will switch over to the sugar and get addicted to the sugar. Now, if you actually look at brain scans or PET scans or functional MRI of people who are obese that overconsume sugar, we see the same neurobiological chemical changes in the brain that you would see with someone who's addicted to cocaine or heroin. So there's a downregulation of the dopamine, the D2 receptors, and it's all occurring with people that overconsume sugar, just like it does with people who are addicted to drugs of abuse.
If you have a question about sugar for scientist James DeNicola Antonio, excuse me, with St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute, call 816-235-2888. We'd also love to hear stories from people who have wrestled with sugar addiction. Tell us about it. 816-235-2888. James, what role does the food industry play in our relationship with sugar, in your view?
So the food industry knows that we love sugar, and the more that they dump in, the more we're going to buy. And unfortunately, overconsuming sugar also leads to food addiction, and you end up actually overconsuming all types of foods, particularly foods high in sugar. So it actually drives overconsumption, and that's certainly good for the food industry, but it's not good for us.
Well, there's an attitude out there, and we've kind of touched on this, but the idea that sugar is natural and therefore eating foods with real sugar is better than diet this and diet that, it sounds like we've kind of missed the point on that, is what I hear you saying. What about like honey? Is that a form of sugar that offers a more healthful alternative?
I would say that the message would be to not switch over to honey as well. You can have a little bit of honey, but the problem is what are called free sugars. So honey would be included in that, but also maple syrup, agave nectar, and even 100% fruit juice.
Curses.
These are all forms. Sorry, say that again?
Oh, I just said curses.
Yeah, unfortunately, even orange juice, 100%, is going to lead to the same metabolic harms as ingesting Coca-Cola. It's basically soda without the buzz. It's 100% fruit juice. It's actually an even higher fructose concentration than some of the sodas out there. So the problem is with juice is you can ingest 8 ounces in about 30 seconds, and you'd have to eat 4 oranges to get the same amount of sugar. So it's not natural, and your body's getting hit with such a high potent dose that it's overwhelming, basically, our ability to control and metabolize that sugar.
Is that even the case if you're, like, juicing your own oranges and not adding anything to it?
That, exactly. It would still be the same if you're taking out all the fiber and all the whole food nutrients in there, and you're just getting the juice from it. If you're having a couple ounces per day, that's okay. But if you're ingesting probably 6 ounces or higher all at once, that's going to cause certain metabolic detriments to the liver.
You're killing me. You make the distinction in your article between concentrated sugar and the kind of sugar we consume in, say, fruit. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So fruit contains sucrose, and it's 50% glucose, 50% fructose, but it's pretty minimal, and it's coming with a nice package of fiber, which is going to slow its absorption, and it's coming with a lot of phytonutrients that are going to inhibit any type of inflammation that fructose brings with it. So there's no harm in consuming fruit. The refined sugars, however, particularly high fructose corn syrup, has even more fructose than 50%. In fact, a lot of the fountain drinks have up to 65-70% fructose. And that's the actual monosaccharide in sugar, the fructose, not the glucose, that causes certain metabolic harms that leads to an overall higher insulin level and causes obesity and type 2 diabetes.
Whoa. Okay. So it's not uncommon to hear people discussing whether they do or don't have a sweet tooth. Are some people more susceptible to a sugar addiction than others?
Yes, definitely. Certain people are going to be more susceptible to being addicted to sugar. So it depends on the threshold that you reach and how long you consume it in order to alter the brain chemistry. But once your brain has been hijacked, once you're in a deficiency of opioids and dopamine in the brain, then you can become addicted.
Your story in the Times was published just 2 days before Christmas in honor of what you call sugar season. That article went viral and it shot way up to the top of the most emailed stories list. Were you surprised by the response?
I wasn't. I think it's an important topic. I think a lot of people understand that the addictive-like properties of sugar. And I think that a lot of people, this topic is extremely important to their health because they're overweight and it's not their fault. And they can't seem to stop eating, and they don't understand what's driving it. And no one's really talking about the sugar addictive properties driving the obesity, type 2 diabetes epidemic. So we know that nicotine addiction is said to be the most preventable addiction as far as causing premature mortality. And in fact, when I've looked at the evidence, sugar addiction is probably much worse than nicotine addiction because it's driving almost all the chronic disease in the United States. And we know that 75% of all U.S. healthcare dollars are being spent on chronic disease. So if we can start looking at obesity not being the sole problem, but being a side effect of being addicted to sugar, and once we can start attacking the sugar which is causing all these problems, then we can actually start fixing the problem.
How has all of this information affected you personally? Do you still eat sugar? I mean, the refined sugar that is added to foods?
So I need to get probably my fix once a day, and I only ingest about up to 10 grams of added sugars. So I'm not trying to tell people totally cut it out because that's going to be very difficult. And especially if you're consuming a high amount, don't go crazy. Start slow and start low and slowly decrease your amounts of added sugars that you're eating. But certainly I consume most of my sugar from whole foods. And if I am going to eat any added sugar, it's never going to come from a beverage because that gives you a really rapid hit and it provides no satiety. And if I do eat some, it's a very minimal amount.
Let's talk to Greg. He's called us at 816-235-2888. Hi, Greg.
Howdy. I just wanted to know if you'd read of Dr. Amon's book that he and his wife worked on. And, he did the research with Rick Warren about a year ago on another book, and he's got a book out about withdrawing from sugar. I wondered if you know of it and what you thought of it. Are you aware of that?
No, I've actually never read the book. And certainly there are studies though that suggest that we should be treating sugar withdrawal and sugar addiction just like we treat people who are addicted to morphine and cocaine and heroin by using opiate antagonists. So we no longer get this intense high when we ingest sugar because we're addicted to the natural endogenous release of our own opioids. And so in order to fix some sugar addiction, it's been said that we need to even treat them just like someone who's addicted to substances of abuse.
And that would imply not going it alone, that you can't just maybe decide, I'm not going to eat this food anymore.
Definitely. Absolutely. And especially for certain diabetics already on medications that cause low blood sugar, can you imagine if everyone just tried to just cut out all of their added sugars all at once, what that could do? So going slow, starting at a slow pace is really what you want to do. You don't want to go cold turkey all at once.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Greg. And James, one point that you make that I'd like to really zero in on is that focusing narrowly on sugar could have the unintended consequence of inspiring various food companies to substitute even more harmful substances. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so if we can package a product that doesn't say added sugars, that doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy, right? So it could have trans fats in it. It could have oxidized omega-6s. So really the focus is shifting away from processed foods and eating more whole foods. That's the message, not to switch one ingredient and giving food manufacturers the go-ahead to just substitute it with something that could be even more harmful, like certain artificial sweeteners.
That speaks to a really bigger tendency and a more general tendency to focus health efforts on identifying what a lot of people think of as evil ingredients and eliminating them from our diets completely or trying to anyway.
Yeah, exactly. The message really is that it's certainly not wrong to identify which substances are likely harmful and try to avoid those. And that's really, that can hit home with a lot of people. If they just cut down their consumption of added sugars, that's going to dramatically improve their health. And then you can start to switch over to, okay, now that I've reduced my added sugar consumption, let's start eating more healthful whole foods as well.
Let's talk to Jack in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, I was actually calling about those potentially deadly sugar substances. I'm a diet drink fan, and sucralose, I think, is generally what I'm drinking. I wondered what your thoughts were on that and the effects on insulin levels.
Take it away, James.
Yeah, I would say that we do have studies on artificial sweeteners and what they do to our gastrointestinal tract and our healthy good bacteria, and they alter them in a way that they start producing inflammation in the gastrointestinal tract, and we end up becoming insulin resistant anyway. And it seems that these diet sugars promote even further hunger, and you can actually increase your absorption of foods that contain carbohydrates with that diet soda. So if you have, let's say, a slice of pizza in the diet soda, you're going to actually absorb more of the sugar from those carbohydrates than without the diet soda, because it's telling your brain that sugar is about to come on board. I better start absorbing it. But the diet soda is not providing any of the sugar, but the sugar is still being provided by other substances. So, and it's also driving your brain to say, wait a second, I didn't get the sugar that I'm supposed to get. So you go out and seek it anyway. I mean, some people can actually tolerate the artificial sweeteners. They don't consume too much of it, and it doesn't cause sugar craving. And if you're one of those people, then that might not be that bad of a thing to switch to. But we still want to be consuming whole foods. We don't want to just eat a packaged product that's in a box just because it doesn't have added sugars. That's not the message.
Let's talk to Carl in Roland Park. Hi, Carl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, my question was on, like, having your fruit smoothies in the morning. I know me and my wife have been doing these, you know, whole fruit smoothies and adding, like, a scoop of protein powder and trying to, you know, get our breakfast fixed that way. What can we do better, or what should we limit ourselves to on that?
Yeah, I would say if you're going to make a smoothie, keep it to about 4 ounces a day. The better alternative is just to eat whole fruits, because the smoothie is eliminating a lot of the fiber and you're getting a lot more sugar in a lot more quick period of time than you would if you were consuming actual whole fruits.
Wow. So that's what do you – I know you didn't come here to propose a brand new diet that will make us all live forever, but do you have some advice for people when it comes to using this information and maybe even just having a healthy attitude toward food?
I like to call it the wild diet. If it exists in the wild, it's probably good for you. And if it doesn't, then you probably should try to avoid it. So anything that you could just pick off a tree or rip from the ground is probably healthy. And that's what we want to try to switch our consumption of food towards, is that type of eating like we used to eat in the Paleolithic era. So the hunter-gatherer type of food consumption is really what our goal is. And so that would even include eating animal products that are set to pasture versus animals that are fed grain and corn that we would never have been able to eat that type of meat back, let's say, 10,000 years ago and beyond. So really, it's what I like to call the wild diet. If it exists in the wild, it's healthy for you. If it comes in a box or packaged, you know, in a plastic bag, it's probably not good for you.
Where can people turn in general for guidelines from a credible source when it comes to nutrition information and diet guidance? Because there is so much fad and so much bad information out there.
I think you can get some good information from dietary guidelines, but I think you can get also a lot of very bad information. So a lot of the dietary guidelines that focus on saturated fat being bad, there's never been any evidence for that when the original dietary goals came out in 1977. In fact, when you look back during that time, all the trials showed no evidence for any type of reduction in cardiovascular events when you try to reduce saturated fat. And so a lot of these guidelines and government policies are based on opinions, and they're not really based on solid evidence. So I would say research yourself. Look at the studies yourself if you can, and maybe follow those experts that you trust and believe in.
James DeNicolantonio, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.